Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
And if we turn off the tap of that icy cold water reaching the ocean's seafloor, you're going to see warming really quickly in response to that. It's not like we need to wait decades to see a response. And I agree, it's kind of surprising. If you think about the oceans at those depths, you think about them being quite slowly moving. But actually, the overturning is pretty vigorous. There's 250 trillion tons of water every year that sinks from the surface around Antarctica into the ocean's abyss. And if you halve that, or even if you drop it down by 15-20%, you're going to see a temperature signature almost in real time.
Welcome, welcome. This show is packed with hard-hitting guests. From Australia, scientist Matthew England explains new Antarctic science that literally changes the whole world. I talk with 11-year-old Zach Fox Duvall about his We the Children podcast. From Public Citizen, Erica T. Patterson reports frontline action to clean up car making, including the surprise worst manufacturer we all thought was so green. I'm Alex Smith. There is no time to waste. Let's get going.
Radio EcoShock.
Deep waters around Antarctica are hiding a shock for the world. The great ocean circulation engine around the Earth may be slowing down faster than we thought. This could affect global fisheries, dead zones, carbon dioxide levels, weather, and sea level rise, among other things. You need to hear this important new science. Bill McKibben says this, not Donald Trump, is the biggest story around. Our guide is study co-author Professor Matthew England. He is deputy director of the ARC Center for Excellence in Antarctic Science. That is located at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Matthew is a veteran scientist and top-level expert. From Sydney, Australia, Matthew England, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Alex. Good to be with you.
So several Radio EcoShock guests have explained the weakening of the ocean current that carries heat to the eastern seaboard, the UK, and northern Europe. But we knew little about the other end of that chain of currents, the Antarctic overturning circulation. Why is so much of your new science coming as a bit of a surprise, even to the experts?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, we've had a lot of measurements in the North Atlantic for such a long, long amount of time. You know, both the European community and the North American community have had shipping vessels there making measurements for a long time. We have measurements as well around Antarctica, but they're much more sparse and there's much less awareness of the southern hemisphere component of this overturning circulation.
Why did you investigate the deep waters around Antarctica? Were there clues or signals of an important change there?
With these measurements, even though they're sparse in time, we have enough of them over the past 30 or 40 years, measurements especially during the 1990s, that we've revisited in the last 10 years, and we could see a signal of very deep ocean warming. And this is at the very bottom of the ocean. And for about 10 years now, we've looked at that warming signal, and scientists haven't been sure whether that's an invasion of anthropogenic heat. And so what I mean by that is that the overturning is completely unchanged in its strength. It's just getting our anthropogenic warming signal into the bottom of the ocean, or that it could have been a slowdown. And so this question for mine went on unanswered for too long, and I wanted to basically configure an ocean model experiment that basically pins down, is it a slowdown or is this warming part of the ocean's ability to sequester heat and put it into the deep ocean? And this set of experiments really was aimed to do that. And the answer that came back was much clearer than I thought it might be. And that is that you can virtually only get that signal with an overturning slowdown. And the reason why I say you can only get that signal with a slowdown is that getting heat from our surface into the bottom of the ocean is hard to do when you're making that surface water fresh and also warm, because you're making the water too buoyant to sink. And so in a way, once we found the answer, it was kind of like, well, of course that's how it works. But I think we needed the model experiments to really tease out the physics in greater detail.
But is it really possible that ice melt in Antarctica could change the Gulf Stream and weather in northern Europe from the other end of the world?
Well, what changes the flow in the Gulf Stream is the melt coming off Greenland primarily. For our study, the overturning circulation off Antarctica sits actually below, if I sort of could draw a cross-section of the world's oceans, the deep ocean is ventilated both from the North Atlantic, where the Gulf Stream flows up towards Greenland, and also from these waters around Antarctica. But what's nice about the ocean system is that the two of them, those two water masses, kind of don't occupy the same volume. So the Gulf Stream overturning, or the North Atlantic overturning, comes in at about 2,000 meters depth. The Antarctic overturning comes right to the bottom of the ocean, down below 4,000 meters, where it resurfaces back up to the surface. So these two overturning cells kind of sit in harmony together. They're both kind of what we call in an on state, which means that they're overturning massive volumes of water from the surface down to the ocean's interior. And it's a very important thing that they do this, because basically our global climate, where our monsoon rains are, how much heat the oceans take up, how much heat goes from the equator to the poles, these really fundamental ways our climate system operates, have been kind of used to these overturning circulations being on and stable for hundreds to thousands of years, and what we're doing at the moment is disrupting them with this meltwater. The bad news is we have massive sheets of ice right near where these overturning circulations are established, and we're adding meltwater at an unprecedented rate in those very locations, and it can lead to change, as we documented in a study.
I was also surprised about the strong role of meltwater compared to wind or temperature. I mean, we're surface creatures. We think, well, the globe is heating and it's the winds are contracting around Antarctica. Those are the drivers of global climate change. But no, meltwater is super important.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, initially in our runs, like for the first 10, 15 years, the winds and warming signal is the biggest signal. But at about the year 2020... About now, so our model runs start as a hindcast, so they run from the 30 years up to today, and then they run to the middle of the 21st century. So we have 30 years either side of today in a way to look at with these simulations. And that wind and thermal forcing is really important at the start. And it's important to remember also, when I talk about meltwater, it's melting because of the warming. So when listeners hear about us separating out the warming effects from meltwater, what we're doing is separating out the warming of the ocean surface from the addition of meltwater to the ocean surface. But it's important to remember it's actually global warming that's driving that ice melt to start with. So back to your comment, it really did surprise me that warming effect of the ocean surface and the wind changes got overwhelmed so strongly by meltwater. It really, when meltwater takes over, and it in a way we're at that point where it is taking over, because the meltwater we're adding is in such big concentrations. There's wonderful animations that NASA put out they're wonderful visually, but they're terrible news for our climate system. The amount of meltwater going into the oceans is just phenomenal right now. And you can't have this meltwater going in and expect it to do nothing to the oceans. You know, quite the contrary. It makes the waters at the surface very buoyant, and that means they don't sink. And so a natural consequence of warming our planet, melting ice, means that we will slow down these overturning circulations. Exactly how much by is going to be set by our future track of carbon emissions.
Well, another surprise, which you mentioned, is that I thought the deep ocean would not warm for centuries. And recent science, including repeated ship measurements, show the low layer of the ocean that we're talking about, below 4,000 meters or about 2.5 miles down, it is warming. What is happening and why?
Yeah, no, 100%. It's a really distinct signal, and it's warming the most right up against Antarctica. So it's not like we just see some patches of warming here or there. There's a very distinct fingerprint of warming that we're seeing in the ocean's abyss. It's warming the fastest near Antarctica, and that amount of warming then attenuates as you move north. And that's a classic signal of an Antarctic overturning slowdown, because you're actually warming the waters closest to the source. You're seeing that impact of the overturning slowdown where you'd expect to see it, right where the slowdown's originating. And as time progresses, that warming signal will strengthen as you go northward, but it's still, you know, the peak signal's going to be right at the Antarctic margin, because that's where this icy cold water has been sinking for centuries. And if we turn off the tap of that icy cold water reaching the ocean's seafloor, you're going to see warming really quickly in response to that. It's not like we need to wait decades to see a response. And it's kind of surprising. If you think about the oceans at those depths, you think about them being quite slowly moving. But actually, the overturning is pretty vigorous. There's 250 trillion tons of water every year that sinks from the surface around Antarctica into the ocean's abyss. And if you halve that, or even if you drop it down by 15, 20%, you're going to see a temperature signature almost in real time.
And the deepest Antarctic waters, they form a giant pool in Earth's oceans, and you found those Antarctic bottom waters are shrinking. Why would the bottom layer shrink, and how does that become a mechanism that enables faster ice melt further up?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so when we talk about the waters shrinking, you sort of think, okay, is that going to drop sea levels? Like you think about a water mass shrinking. What we mean is if we go look at the volume of water, say, colder than a certain temperature, that volume of water colder than 0 degrees, and remember, seawater only freezes at minus two almost, so we do have sub-zero water down there, and that's the water form in Antarctica. The volume of that water that's below 0 degrees Celsius is contracting. We've already got estimates of that from observations, and that's what we see in our model. And so that contraction just means we're losing that icy cold water, and it then gets filled, you know, that void that you leave by not overturning the water around Antarctica down to the ocean abyss. You basically see the water above it, the warm water above it, slump down. And it's the best verb to use, that sort of slumps down, basically collapses down. You would see a slight signature in sea level from this, but other things are going on as well with that, with ocean warming. But yeah, with that water turning off around Antarctica, you do see a contraction. And as you said, one of the real concerns that I see in our simulations is that you see, in response, a warming up on the shelf. So the bottom of the ocean, right up near Antarctica's ice caps, that water there warms, especially in the West Antarctic sector. And the reason that's a big concern is that the very signal creating this deep ocean warming is meltwater, and you're actually creating more warming right where the meltwater is. And that's what we call in climate system science a positive feedback or an amplifying feedback, where the initial change that you trigger actually cascades to more changes that reinforce the original change. And we don't want to see those sorts of things play out, because when they do, it means that we're pushing the climate system with a little nudge, and it's responding by taking that nudge into changes that reinforce the original change, and you get then a really rapid change. And you know, that's the sort of thing we don't want to see around West Antarctica, because of the ice sheets that flow into the ocean at those sea levels. And the meltwater that's being added there, if it has this amplifying feedback, it would mean that our sea level estimates for the coming century need revising, with extra warmth expected there on the shelf.
So we've got unimaginable amounts of ice sitting in glaciers on land on Antarctica, and then we have these great ice shelves that are prodding out into the sea. If those were to melt away, do they add to sea level rise around the world, or why does it matter if they do melt faster, the ice shelves?
Yeah, exactly. So the ice shelves themselves are floating. It's an amazing structure of ice around Antarctica. You've got the actual land beneath the Antarctic ice sheet. It's quite amazing to look at it. You can go online for your listeners, go and Google, you know, what's the bedrock shape. Antarctica is not a big continent of bedrock with ice sitting on top of it. It's actually a lot of islands, a lot of smaller land masses. I sometimes sort of hold my fingers up in a talk and imagine me holding a block of ice with my fingertips on top of it, because it really looks like that in some parts of Antarctica, especially around the West Antarctic. So that land ice that sits on those chains of bedrock that support it, when that land ice melts, it raises the sea levels. But the actual ice shelves themselves are an extension of the land ice that's now effectively floating on the water. So the ice shelf melt doesn't itself raise sea levels, but unfortunately, we know those ice shelves, whilst they float in water, they actually buttress. They give some sort of pushback to the ice sheets behind them. And so this flow of the glaciers off the land into the ocean that becomes these ice shelves. If you lose the ice shelves there, you actually accelerate the flow. It's very clear. We've seen ice shelves going around Antarctica, and the stream flow of the land ice behind those ice shelves unfortunately accelerates when you lose the ice shelves. So it's a complex array of ice, but if we start losing bits of that ice, even the sea ice is problematic to lose. That's another type of ice that actually floats entirely on seawater. It's formed every winter when it gets cold enough, just like you'd see over the Great Lakes where it's cold enough. This ice forms out of the seawater. Losing that ice as well has potential amplifying effects because of the ice albedo. And so the short message is this ice that we have over Earth's surface is a critical part of our climate system. It reflects heat. It actually stores fresh water that would otherwise raise sea levels if we melt it. And any big change like we're seeing down there, it can affect ocean circulation and there can be further feedbacks. But it really, we don't want to change the concentration, volume, distribution of ice on our planet. We are unfortunately changing it with our emissions of greenhouse gases. And there are big knock-on effects through sea level rise, through changes in ocean circulation, and so on.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about big changes to oceans around Antarctica, which will affect the whole world. Our guest is Professor Matthew England from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. Getting to the heart of the problem, I think we have two disturbing discoveries here. One is the process, and the other is timing. Would you remind our listeners about the basic of global ocean circulation and how your new science fits into that?
I mean, the ocean circulation on our planet has been relatively stable for a long period of time. All of the development of our cities, all of the location of where we have our farming, agriculture, water management, huge developments of infrastructure that support humanity and support our ability to produce food and water and so on has been developed during this relatively stable climate period up until about 100 years ago when we started to see the very first signs of human interference with the climate system. These currents that we talk about, the Gulf Stream extension up into the far North Atlantic or the overturning of Antarctica, they set how our planet's climate works. And I don't think 30 or 40 years ago when we first looked at how greenhouse gases would change our climate. Initially, we just think about warming of the atmosphere, more heat waves, definitely thermal expansion and sea level rise, and definitely ice melt. But the cascading through of these changes to resetting, to halving the overturning circulation around Antarctica, I think is surprising. We're talking about the textbook description of how the oceans work. They have a ventilation of these waters from the surface to the ocean abyss that keep them healthy. If you think about a fish tank, nobody in there, would set up a fish tank with stagnant water, where the water just sits still and the fish basically have to live in that environment with no overturning, if you like, within the fish tank. It's a good parallel for the oceans. If we lose this abyssal overturning of water from the surface to back to the top, we sort of cut out a way that the oceans overturn or renew, and we cut out a way that oxygen gets into the oceans. And so there are knock-on effects for marine life. We won't thankfully see extinction of marine life at the surface because this overturning is cut down, because there are other ways that the oceans ventilate at the surface. There are waves and swell, that waves break and that puts oxygen into the ocean, and there's nutrients that come in off the land, and there's a whole marine life cycle that happens at the surface that is an intricate web of these processes occurring. But if we cut out the resurfacing of nutrients from the bottom of the ocean back to the surface, we're taking out a really important bit of the marine food web. We're taking out a source of nutrients that will be noticeable for those upper ocean ecosystems. And in terms of the timescale of change, that plays out progressively. If you take out the nutrients coming back to the surface over time, you just end up leaving a lot of nutrients in the ocean abyss. There was a study out, not related to ours, by other authors a couple of years ago, looking at the hypothetical, what happens if this slows down. And they showed this ecosystem impact really clearly, that you lose some of the phytoplankton productivity at the surface by keeping the nutrients right down the bottom of the ocean. And that in turn means that you lose some of the ocean's ability to uptake carbon. So all these changes that are related to a slowdown, they might seem small on a year-to-year basis, but integrated over time, as the next few decades play out in the next century, they're going to have impacts that are potentially very costly to us, and that's why we keep talking about addressing the root cause of these emissions that we're putting into the atmosphere.
Yes, in February 2023, I interviewed Dr. Keith Moore. He's a professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. He co-authored several papers on declining marine biological productivity due to slower overturning circulation. He warns plankton will get less food, as you just said, if the overturning weakens. And, you know, probably a billion people depend on seafood for protein, and the whole ocean web depends on this stuff. These are serious, serious changes we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. First order stuff, fundamental parts of the way we rely on the ocean. And people come to, in a way, take the ocean for granted. You know, it moderates our climate. It provides a huge proportion of the world's population with food. They also take up carbon for us, which they only take up carbon... Well, they take up carbon for a couple of reasons, but one of the big reasons is this biological productivity that's there, and it's really that phytoplankton level. It's a bit like planting forests to draw down carbon on land. The algae in the ocean, the marine life that photosynthesizes in the ocean, also needs those nutrients to be viable, and cutting off a source of nutrients is the last thing you want to do when you rely on the oceans, as we do as humans on this planet. We rely on the oceans for food production. We rely on the oceans for absorbing carbon and taking a quarter of our emissions out of the atmosphere and keeping them in the ocean. And these sorts of three services, if you like, of ocean climate mitigation are really important for keeping our climate stable, for providing us with food and so on.
The other shocker, Matthew, is how fast this ocean system could tip. Frankly, most experts were using the language, well, we may have started a process that will enlarge after 2100 and beyond in the coming centuries or millennia. What does your new science tell us about the possible timing of big changes?
Yeah, I think that a lot of these changes that we're seeing play out, you know, we're rarely coming across a system where we go, oh, this is changing slower than we thought. This is not just our work that seems to be outpacing projections. I think a lot of people are finding some of the worst impacts of climate change, whether it's bleaching coral reefs, increases in heat waves or so on. Things are playing out faster than a lot of the projections we had would suggest. And so, you know, this is a real concern. We're in a situation right now where the pace of change is such that adaptation measures are becoming urgent. And so we're, you know, the very work that we need to do to reduce emissions is one part of the problem that we need to solve urgently. What concerns me a lot is if governments start going, well, gee, the changes that are coming along, they're also bad, and we need to start getting ready for those changes. And the resources then are effectively spread thinly, you know, rather than getting to the root cause and solving that as we should have been doing for the last couple of decades. Governments have been lazy to solve that problem. And now we're seeing adaptation measures, seawalls, desalination plants to provide drinking water, whole-scale shifts of where farming is undertaken. I mean, these sorts of changes are incredibly costly, and what concerns me is that the pace of change over the next few decades will be such that governments start to put their time and energy into those adaptation measures, which are important to do, but the problem is our pace of change is set by greenhouse gas emissions, and some really, really critical work at reducing those emissions is being, you know, in a way, back-ended for future generations to solve by not addressing those emissions today.
Do you think a decrease in the ocean overturning in the southern latitudes would affect weather in South America, Australia, or New Zealand?
Yeah, there are ways that if you slow the overturning down, you change the way that the planetary energy budget works. You actually change the amount of heat coming towards Antarctica on a very global scale. A previous study that I wasn't part of out of the US showed that if you slow the overturning circulation, you actually shift rainfall in the tropics. You shift it a bit away from the southern hemisphere and push it a bit more into the northern hemisphere. So there is that effect. But on top of that, with rainfall especially, there's you know, greenhouse gas warming is also making our whole atmosphere more humid. It's changing El Nino, La Nina cycles, we think, making them more intense. So there are other changes going on top of the overturning slowdown. So in this paper, we didn't, and the media that followed, we really focused on those two other effects that we spoke about earlier, one being the feedback to further ice shelf melt, which I think is a really worrying one because it plays out in near real time, and the other one being this nutrient resupply back to the surface. But you're right, the overturnings are so significant both in the Southern Ocean and in the North Atlantic that if you change them, you do have an impact on stuff that seems far away, like the tropical rainfall belts are shifted north or south.
Who is monitoring these big changes in the southern latitudes? Will we know if it is happening and how fast?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question, and we've got observing systems out there that a lot of the nations who are making measurements in the Southern Ocean have seen evidence enough that of some of these overturning changes, and now where we put our moorings and where we put our data observing platforms are partly gauged to measure those changes. Having said that, it's really hard because Antarctica is such a vast distance to surround it, to go and put in moorings that measure all the flows that come off the continent down to the ocean abyss is really tricky. So we don't tend to track this by looking at the ocean flows, but instead we look at the proxies for the ocean flow, which are things like oxygen, because this water is very high in oxygen compared to the surrounding water masses, and also things like temperature and salinity. So we're focusing measurements of the ocean abyssal changes with these much more practical means. Temperature, oxygen especially, are very good for tracking how this overturning is going. Unfortunately, those measures that we're seeing, you know, suggest we're not about to see a slowdown, but that we're actually midway through one. Whether we're 10% into a slowdown or 20% or 5% is much harder to estimate, but definitely the measurements we have around the continent suggest we're midway through a slowdown.
If this circulation system tips within coming decades, many of my listeners will be alive as those changes take place. Assuming we don't cut our emissions as we must in the next few years, what would people see in 2040 or 2050 that is different?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest impact over the next few decades will be that feedback onto further ice melt. And so our rates of sea level rise so far have been quite manageable, even so, there's certainly been seeing low-lying regions of the world notice those changes. And when I say manageable, so far we've had 25 or so centimetres, you know, 12, 13, 14 inches, that sort of dimension of change over the last century or so. That's enough to be detectable. What we're expecting in the coming century could be as much as a metre. So I'm bad with my conversion to imperial units, but I think it's about 3 foot of change could occur in the next 80 years, and that level of sea level rise would see big impacts on all the world's coastlines. You know, cities and communities that living by the seaside would see inundations occurring more frequently, potentially having to see mass migrations from low-lying, or definitely see mass migrations out of low-lying mega-deltas through Asia. Pacific islands that are low-lying would have to be abandoned. And this is, you know, people hear that news and if they're not living there, they don't necessarily see that as an issue. But the global political instability, and it's selfish to think that, obviously, because these are people whose communities have relied on those lands to live on for thousands and thousands of years. It's terrible to see that loss of human habitat. But don't for a moment think that wouldn't be a global problem. Mass migrations out of some of these low-lying areas that are very heavily populated, because after all, as you mentioned earlier, we rely on the oceans for food and so on. Mass migration out of these regions would lead to knock-on effects globally. This is not my area of research, but a lot of people who look at political instability, one of the biggest concerns with climate change is that political instability that would occur with mass migration out of some regions and into others. It puts a tremendous strain on the whole world, not just the people who have to relocate. It's really alarming to think about how much some of these changes could knock on, not just from the overturning circulation that we're describing in this paper, but from all of climate change altering the habitability of some of these regions.
As we wrap up, is there anything you would like to add, or would you like to tell us what you're working on now?
No, look, I'm the main thing, main message I'm trying to push is that all is not lost with this overturning circulation. It's not like it's doomed to slow down and be extinguished for all of time. We can address the problem of ice melt by slowing our emissions, by getting them to net zero, and we need to. Otherwise, from very basic ocean physics, you know, with virtual certainty, we will slow these overturning circulations down and they will be extinguished, and they're not easy to switch back on. And so my main message is, you know, this is yet another wake-up call amongst many for addressing the root source of emissions. But from a scientific point of view, it's what my group's really, really concerned to go look at next is this feedback on the Amazon-Bellingshausen Sea, so that West Antarctic sector that I spoke about, the warming there. We really need to understand that warming, how it plays out, how much ice melt would then be achieved by that warming, because it's of the whole system that changes in response to the slowdown, that's the one that's so visible and so clearly visible early in the projections that it has my concern.